Good day, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradox of Sunday School class. Dr. Ross is back with us now, happy to say. And everybody's wandering in here. So have a seat when you can. We got some good treats today, so help yourself. And today is the first day of fall in the Northern Hemisphere. So for our friends in Australia, New Zealand, South America, so on, happy first day of spring. I think everything lines up that way. Dr. Ross will tell you what he's going to be talking about in a few minutes. He'll be here today and next week. And then Dave Sargent will be talking again on the accuracy of the Bible, Dave? Yes, okay. And Dave has brought the book table today again, so are there freebies again, Dave? Or, okay, for, take a look at the book table over there and see if there's one you might need or want. Let's see. I think that's all. So let's bow our heads for a moment. I'll say a prayer. Lord God, we seek your blessing on our class. Tune our hearts and minds to receive your word and the words of your creation, the wonder of your creation. Equip us to be good witnesses of what we learn here today. Bless Dr. Ross's message with accuracy and power. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Come on up, Dr. Ross.
I think it's on now. There we go. Thank you. Well, it's good to be back here in the Paradoxes class. Been gone for several weeks. I'm going to be here today and next week, then traveling again, speaking in the central and eastern parts of the U.S. for a couple of weeks, and then I'll be back for a long stretch. And so what I'll be doing today and next week is a short series on health, the Bible, and physics. And you'll see how that all integrates. And then when I come back after ministering in Nebraska and Kansas and South Carolina, Virginia, etc., I'll start a series on Noah's Flood. I just finished a book on Noah's Flood, and now I reckon the reason I was motivated to write the book, it's the number one reason why people not raised in the church reject the Bible as the inspired and inerrant word of God, and therefore don't even consider giving their lives to Jesus Christ. Now, this past week, I was at UC Berkeley at a conference, and it was a conference of people gathered together, what can we do to help the health crises, particularly in the poorest nations of the world? And they invited me to give a talk. And I'm going to give the talk, well, a version of the talk that I gave at UC Berkeley, make it a little less technical. And then following that, I'm going to give a talk the following Sunday on the physics of cancer, the astrophysics of cancer. So, and you say, what is all this happening here? You're a physicist, you're an astronomer. Why are you delving in to medical science? Well, for the past 3 years, I've been collaborating with an international team of medical researchers, and we've come up with a book already. We're planning two more books, but they invited me to be part of the team because they said, what's been ignored in medical research are the physical sciences, and so they've invited me to help work with them, but also to recruit other physicists, astronomers, and geologists to collaborate with them, and how to integrate the medical and the life sciences in with the physical sciences to address some of the major health crises in the world, and not just health crises, helping people that are healthy to be even healthier. So with that in mind, I'm going to jump in and begin with a couple of biblical principles that I think are key for dealing with health issues that we're facing. Number one, recognize all humans are sinful and therefore can be expected to act selfishly. And we see that in the economy of the world, but we also see it in the way that people respond to health. They're most concerned about their health, not so much the health of others. Or they may be concerned about the health of their family, but not the health of other families. Which means we need to manage healthcare in such a way that we're cognizant of the fact that people are fundamentally selfish. Or, for example, in their desire to gain wealth and high standing in society, they may not act in the ways that are most healthy for themselves and others. And then secondly, a principle we draw from Genesis and Job. I mean, if you look at Genesis chapter 1, it ends with God granting humanity a mandate. He says to Adam and Eve, and through them all the descendants of Adam and Eve, I'm putting you in charge of planet Earth. I'm making you responsible to manage all of its resources for your benefit and the benefit of all their life. And there's a couple of promises there. God is saying, I've given you the resources that you need, and I've given you sufficient resources that you'll never have to choose what's beneficial for yourself as opposed to what's beneficial for the rest of humanity, or you'll never have to choose what's beneficial for human beings and what's beneficial for the rest of life on planet Earth. Basically, it's an exhortation. Trust me, I've given you all the resources that you need. Look for win-win-win solutions. Do not settle where you're benefiting humanity, but you're not benefiting the rest of Earth's life. Or don't settle where you're benefiting a portion of humanity and you're ignoring the rest of the human species. Look for these solutions. Okay, the conference I was at UC Berkeley was focusing on health crises in Asia. And they were talking about, how we need better hospitals equipped to be able to do open heart surgery, deal with different cancers. But they invited me to speak on a health crisis that could actually save the Asian medical industry a huge amount of money. Basically, we're talking about preventive health. What if we could step in and take care of things in the environment of Asia that would automatically make everybody healthier, and especially the poorest people that are living in Asia? So I spoke on what has been identified by the World Health Organization as the greatest health crisis in Asia. And it's not the rising cancer rate, it's not the rising rate of heart disease, it's not obesity, although this health crisis contributes to all of those, and it's air pollution. Okay, this is a photograph of a good day in Delhi, a city of 30 million people, the capital of India. And on a good day, you can always look at the sun with a naked eye, even at noon. So that's a good day in Delhi. And here's a bad day in Delhi. Now, there's a building 200 meters away. It's a big, huge building. But the air pollution is so intense that you can't see the building. It's basically the railway transportation system. So you're walking in here. This is the gateway to that building, but you can't see the building, even though it's only 200 meters away. And we're not just talking Delhi. This is a problem in every major city within Asia. And this is even true of the big cities that are not part of the Asian mainland. So for example, this is a good day in Manila. This is the capital city of the Philippines. So you would think that the ocean surrounding it would help clean up the air, but as you can see here, it's pretty bad. Now, before we get down on the Asians, when I first came to California, I got my PhD at the University of Toronto in December of 1972. I arrived at Caltech in January of 1973, and guess what? The air looked like that. So some of you who are older, who've lived here for decades, can remember when the air pollution was that bad here in the Los Angeles basin. I mean, I remember being at Caltech for 3 months before I realized, oh, there's mountains in front of Caltech. even though those mountains are only 3 miles away, you couldn't see them. And I also remember arriving on the Caltech campus, and right away my eyes were stinging and my eyes were watering, and I thought I had, you know, there's something wrong with me. I need to see a doctor. And it was a friend of mine at Caltech who says, oh no, all of us have stinging eyes. All of us have eyes that are watering. It's the acid that's in the air. Okay, now, there's a reason why it's not like that in the Los Angeles basin anymore. In fact, what we notice is almost every large American city has way better air quality than they had 50 years ago. But the situation is such that today, 99 of the 100 cities in the world with the worst air pollution are in Asia. There's only one that's not in Asia. And 83 of those 100 are in the nation of India. Okay. Now, worldwide, only 9% of 7,800 cities, there are 7,800 cities that actually monitor their air pollution, only 9% meet the minimum standards of the World Health Organization. And that standard is this, that it's considered to be unhealthy if there's more than 5 micrograms of particulate matter in the atmosphere, particulate matter less than 2.5 micrograms per cubic meter. Now think about that. That's 5 millionths of a gram in a cubic meter. If it's more than that, you're going to have health issues. If it's less than that, other things will get to you. Now, those 9% of the cities that are being monitored that actually meet the minimum health standards of the World Health Organization, all of them are in Canada, the United States, and Western Europe. And Canada, the United States, and Western Europe have done something that the other nations of the world have not. Okay, this particulate matter pollution, we're not talking about the particulate matter you get, say, from an open campfire. I mean, how many have ever enjoyed going camping and having a campfire? I understand now you can't do that in California anymore. When I first arrived here in California, we would enjoy going to the high Sierra Mountains, setting up our tents, and having an open fire. And that open fire does release particulate matter, but it's typically releasing particulate matter that is bigger than 10 micrometers across. And our lungs are designed to be able to handle that kind. Now, if you oversaturate it, so for example, if you're exposed to open fire day in, day night, you will have health consequences. But an occasional exposure to an open fire like that, and this is called PM10 particulate pollution, which means that the particulate matters are bigger than 10 micrometers across. So we're designed to be able to handle that as long as we're not dealing with it on a daily basis. However, the real problem is this, and this is what's called PM2.5 particulate pollution. And this is particulate matter where the particles are smaller than 2.5 micrometers. Now, to give you an example, think of a single human hair. A single human hair is 30 times the diameter of PM2.5 particulate matter. So we're talking very tiny particles. And the problem here is human lungs, and it's not just human lungs, it's the lungs of any bird or mammal, is not able to deal with continual exposure to particulate matter that's that small. Okay, and most of this comes from the generation of electricity by burning coal, by burning diesel fuel, oil, biofuels, and the poorer parts of the world, they burn dung. They'll take the animal dung and they burn that to heat their homes and to cook their food. Now, only recently, as the World Health Organization actually documented the extent of the health hazards of being exposed to this what's called PM2.5 air pollution. You get an increased rate of heart attacks. Lung cancer, that's an obvious thing. Lung cancer rate goes way up. other cancers. It's not just lung cancer. Turns out that exposure to these particulates actually impacts your kidneys, your liver, your brain, your spleen. All the organs are affected. Obviously, it aggravates asthma. In fact, I was in India last October, and my asthma really acted up. I was just there for 2 weeks. I was able to recover from it. Fibrosis is way up. Aggravated heart disease, aggravated lung disease, organ failure. If you're exposed to significant PM2.5 air pollution, it literally causes, over time, all your organs to stop functioning. And everybody who's exposed to this, even the healthiest and youngest individuals, they all experience lower lung function. So if you live in parts of the world where there's a lot of this pollution, your lungs, even if you're very healthy and strong, will not function at the optimal level, and everybody will experience an irregular heartbeat. So the last two affects even the healthiest of humans, and the thing that's at the top of the list is lung cancer and something called COPD. That's a lung disease, and what we now know is that Asia has by far the highest incidence of COPD of any nation in the world. Now, what is the impact on this? Again, this has only recently been documented by the World Health Organization. For Asia as a whole, it lowers life expectancy by 3.0 years. In other words, Asians live 3 years less on average than people who are not exposed to that level of particulate matter pollution. Western China is doing quite well because there's no big cities there, and that's not where they generate electricity. But Eastern China, where virtually most of the Chinese population live, their life expectancy is shortened by 4.4 years, Bangladesh 4.9 years, India as a whole 5.3. Indians who live in the Ganges Valley, 470 million people live in the Ganges Valley. Their life expectancy is shortened by 8 years, and people live in Delhi and New Delhi, it's shortened by 11.9 years. Now, Delhi is not the worst air pollution city in the world, but is the worst of the really big cities. There are smaller cities of, say, 1 million people that actually, where the life expectancy is shortened even beyond 11.9 years. Now, this is only what happens when you're exposed to PM2.5 air pollution. When you burn coal, when you burn diesel, when you burn biofuels, or where you burn animal dung, you also get aerosols being released in the atmosphere. This data does not take into account the health impact of sulfur aerosols, nitrous oxides, etc. But the World Health Organization estimates that in parts of the world where people have their life expectancy shortened by 5 years or more as exposure to PM2.5, you can probably add another year of lifespan being abbreviated by the exposure to these aerosols that result from the burning of these fuels. So, now, if you've got a population where their lifespan is being shortened by 12 years, this adds up to a very huge health cost. So I was speaking at UC Berkeley saying, if we can resolve this problem, we're gonna be able to release a lot of doctors and nurses and healthcare facilities to deal with other health issues. This is costing the Asian healthcare system a huge amount of money. And of course, it's costing the economy a lot of money because that means you've got people not able to work for 12 years. If you're shortening the lifespan by 12 years, that means that during those years, that's just 12 less years, you've got people able to contribute to the economy, able to pay taxes to support the healthcare system. And so my whole point was, if we can address this problem, it would be the fastest and quickest way to bring about a healthier population, stimulate the Asian economy, and basically said, let's look at Canada, the United States, and Western Europe. They don't have this problem. The reason why they don't have this problem, they're getting almost all of their electricity from natural gas. They're burning fossil fuels, but they burn natural gas. They basically said, we're not going to generate electricity from coal or oil or diesel fuel. We're going to get it from natural gas. And hey, if we can complement that with wind and solar and water power, so much the better. But I can tell you this, even Canada, which has a huge amount of water power resources, they still get most of their electricity from burning natural gas. And so it is the primary source in those nations. But when you burn natural gas instead of these other fossil fuels, you have zero particulate matter pollution. You don't get the PM10, you don't get the PM5, you don't get the PM2.5. You get no particulate matter pollution at all and no aerosols. So you're immediately eliminating this huge health crisis if you simply say, we're not going to generate electricity from burning coal anymore or biofuels. We're going to use natural gas. And guess what? Natural gas is cheaper. One reason why Canada, the U.S., and Western Europe switched to natural gas, it boosted their economy. It's a cheaper way to get electricity. And also, it reduces greenhouse gases by nearly a half. The reason why you get a big greenhouse gas emission reduction, natural gas is CH4. It's methane. One carbon, four hydrogen. And so when you burn it, what do you get? Carbon dioxide, but mostly you get water. Now, water is a greenhouse gas. Water vapor is a greenhouse gas. But when you pump a lot of water vapor in the atmosphere and you increase that, what happens to that water vapor? It condenses as rain and snow. And so what's happened in the United States, Canada, and Western Europe, they're the nations of the world that have done the most in reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Now, politicians will tell you it's because they're so aggressive in developing wind and solar. But the biggest reason that they've been able to drop their greenhouse gas emissions is they're using natural gas instead of other fossil fuels. When you burn coal, almost all of it is carbon dioxide. You do get a little bit of sulfur dioxide, but guess what? That's a greenhouse gas. You get aerosols. It does contribute to the health. But with methane, you get a factor two drop in greenhouse gases. It's the fastest way for the nations of the world to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. No other technique can reduce it that fast. You say, well, if we convert everything to wind and solar, wouldn't that do the trick? Yes, it would, but it's going to take a couple of decades. Even nations that are very aggressively pursuing wind and solar, they're realizing it's going to take a long time. Moreover, typically when you're doing wind and solar, you're taking agricultural land out of production. Now, you know, instead of growing crops, you have a solar panel field. And that's something that's difficult to implement in Asia because you've got, you know, 4.5 billion people living there, and they need all the agricultural land that they can access. So they don't have the luxury that Canada has, for example, of taking uninhabited parts of Canada and covering it with solar panels. The other problem with solar panels and wind is that the sun has to be out, or the wind has got to be blowing. It's not like water power where you know the water is going to flow night and days 24/7. And so you'll have times where the electricity is not available. That's the advantage of natural gas. If you need more electricity, you just burn more natural gas. And so people realize what's working in Canada, the United States, and Western Europe, they're able to complement those periods when wind and solar is not delivering the energy they need by using natural gas. It's a good complement to wind and solar. So this really looks like a win-win solution. It's been implemented in the United States and Canada and Western Europe for the simple reason they can get the natural gas to where it's needed. Okay, there's a barrier for this being the solution for Asia. Asia doesn't have a lot of natural gas resources. They've got some, but North America is sitting on the largest deposits of natural gas in the world. Now, you can't build a pipeline from North America to Asia. I suppose you could, but that's a, you know, a multi-year project. And so typically what you do is you use these kinds of ships. And this ship literally can take millions of cubic feet of natural gas to anywhere in the world. Why? Because they liquefy it. You liquefy the natural gas, which means that a ship like this can carry nearly 700 times as much natural gas as if it was in the gaseous form. So there's these ports in the world where they use a pipeline to ship the natural gas to the port, and then they compress it and liquefy it, put it on one of these big liquid natural gas tankers, and then they send the tanker ship to those parts of the world that could use natural gas. So this seems to be the economic solution. Let's just have North America ship all the natural gas that the Asians need. It would boost the North American economy, because now they'd be selling all this natural gas. It would boost the Asian economy because it's cheaper than what they're burning already. And it would be boost their economy, and it overnight would eliminate this health crisis. And Asia has been labeled as the nations in the world that are most contributing to global warming. If they're burning natural gas instead of these other fossil fuels, they could become the champion of lowering greenhouse gas emissions. So this seems like a no-brainer. Here's the problem. We have North Americans and Europeans who had this idea that, hey, if we're going to stabilize the climate, we need to eliminate all fossil fuel burning. And so they've actually instituted a ban on the building of liquid natural gas ports. Canada is considering it. The United States actually has put that into practice, saying we're not going to allow the building of any more natural gas exporting ports or building of these ships because we think all fossil fuels are bad. And it's like, wait a minute. Yes, some fossil fuels are bad, but some are better than others, and there's no faster way. We can't get to wind and power that quickly. So it's the ban on the building of liquid natural gas export ports in North America. Now, fortunately, this ban was instituted by the executive branch of the United States. Congress has not yet considered this. And the people in the Senate are saying this was a wrong-headed move. And so there's hope that our Congress will step in and say, wait a minute, we're actually made a bad decision here. And hopefully that ban will be reversed. Now, I spoke on this mainly to people who are Americans involved in Christian missions, saying the way we're going to get the executive branch here in the United States to reverse this decision is that we're not going to talk about the climate. We're not going to talk about the economy. We're going to talk about the health crisis in Asia and how it's uncompassionate for us in America to allow Asians to have their lifespan terminated by 5 to 12 years. We're to blame. We can fix this simply by giving them the natural gas that they need. And so if we look upon it as an act of compassion and helping Asia deal with its health crisis, then I think we can get that ban lifted. In fact, I would say Mexico, by the way, is considering building liquid gas natural exporting ports. Canada's got two that are being built in British Columbia right now. But I look at that and say, that needs to be aggressively accelerated. Instead of building two in Canada and one in Mexico and maybe thinking about one or two in America, we need to be thinking about 20. If we're really going to serve Asia's needs, we need to accelerate that. Now, that can be done in relatively short order. Now we're talking, I mean, the easiest thing to do, and this is what happened in the United States and Canada and Western Europe, is they said, well, you know, getting natural gas into people's homes for helping them with their heating, their air conditioning, their cooking, that takes time to set up the infrastructure. You've basically got to put pipes into all these homes. We've done that here in the United States, but it takes time. It takes a couple of years to build that up, but the quickest thing to do is simply convert an electricity generating plant from burning coal to burning natural gas, because they consume a lot of fossil fuel. All you need to do is bring it to one place. You really don't need an extensive pipeline system of distribution. Optimally, you want to bring it into all the homes throughout Asia, but begin first with the electricity generating plants. Then you can go after the steel plants. They consume a lot of fossil fuel. And that's what happened here in the Los Angeles Basin. They basically instituted natural gas into all the homes of people living here. But notice what they did. They shut down the steel mills, and the steel mills moved out of the LA area, and then they switched to natural gas. Within a couple years, our air quality went from being just like it is in Asia to being acceptable and meeting the World Health Organization standards. Now, what I argued at UC Berkeley, natural gas is a temporary solution. I mean, I agree with the environmentalists. We need to get to a point where we're not having to burn fossil fuels to generate our energy needs. The problem is we don't have a solution in place to get all of our electricity immediately unless we burn fossil fuels. Let's burn natural gas. It generates only half the greenhouse gases. But I ended my talk with what I call the permanent solution. And I call it a permanent solution, but it is one that's going to take a decade to institute. Natural gas will buy us the years that we need to bring about the permanent solution. What is that permanent solution? Generate electricity from thorium nuclear reactors. Now, here again we deal with a public misperception. The public here in America and the Western world thinks all nuclear power generation is bad, just like they think all fossil fuel burning is bad. Well, there's a big difference between generating electricity from uranium and generating electricity from thorium. I agree, uranium is not a good option. We have many uranium nuclear reactors in the Western world. Notice we're shutting them down. We had a big one here in Southern California that has been shut down. And the reason why they've been shutting them down, the radioactive toxic wastes remain unsafe for about 50,000 years. So if you were to have, say, 100,000 nuclear power plants all over the world, you've got this problem. What do we do with all these radioactive wastes, and where are we going to put it? You know, people are saying, well, there's a mountain in Nevada that we can store it under. But I noticed the citizens in Nevada said, not in our backyard. We're not going to have all those radioactive things sitting there. And people are saying, can we ship them to the backside of the moon? And the astronomers are saying, hey, there's a lot of research we can do in the backside of the moon. We don't want that stuff there either. So there's a problem. But one of the things we notice is if you go with thorium instead of uranium, to generate your electricity. Number one, by the way, I have this photo here. We actually had thorium nuclear reactors as far back as 1962. This is the Indian Point thorium nuclear reactor in Buchanan, New York. In fact, there were two of them functioning here in the United States in the 1960s. You say, well, how come we didn't replace the uranium reactors with thorium reactors back then? Number one reason that we didn't pursue thorium, you can't make nuclear bombs out of thorium nuclear reactors. And so it's like, well, in that case, let's forget about it. However, we're now in the 21st century, and we now realize that anybody can build a uranium-thorium nuclear reactor. I mean, the North Koreans are doing it, the Iranians are doing it, and it's like they're making nuclear bombs. And they're all saying, hey, we're just having these nuclear reactors to generate electricity. We're going to use it for peaceful purposes. But remember what I said earlier? People are fundamentally selfish. And so can you expect everybody to keep their word when they got selfish ends in place? I don't think so. We're now in a different situation. We could actually export thorium nuclear reactors to North Korea, recognizing they can't use them to make nuclear weapons. Now, there's a caveat. you actually can use a thorium nuclear reactor to make a nuclear weapon, but it kills everybody that's involved in the process. So that's a fairly strong motivation to prevent them from using thorium nuclear reactors to make nuclear weapons. Everybody's going to die. That's part of the project. Okay, but here's some other advantages. Thorium is 3 times as abundant as uranium, and it delivers way more energy than uranium. 1 ton of thorium delivers the energy equivalent of 200 tons of uranium. So you get 200 times the energy. And if you compare it to coal, it's 3,500,000 times more energy than you would get with coal. And there's enough thorium in the crust of the Earth to meet 100% of humanity's total power needs for at least 1,000 years, probably more than 1,000 years, but the easy-to-mine thorium would hold us for at least 1,000 years, and we're talking 100% the energy you need for your automobiles, air conditioning, heating, electricity, everything. And the radioactive waste you get from thorium nuclear reactors is 0.1% of what you get from uranium, 1,000 times less radioactive waste. Instead of it being dangerous for 50,000 years, it's only dangerous for 50 to 200 years. That's a short enough window of time that we're not going to have a storage crisis. We can find places to store it, realizing, hey, after 100 to 200 years, we can replace it with more waste. And so unlike uranium, where you've got an insoluble storage problem, there is no problem with thorium. And it's safer and more efficient to mine than uranium. When you mine these concentrated uranium ores, the miners have to wear protective gear. And they can only mine for a certain period of time. They're monitored with these devices to see how much radiation they're exposed to. That's not a problem with thorium. They don't have to wear protective gear, and they don't have to be limited in how much time they're mining the thorium. They can mine it for the rest of their life. It's not going to affect their health. A huge advantage of thorium nuclear reactors, it's impossible to have a meltdown. There will be no meltdown accidents like what happened in Russia and Japan. Totally safe for the power plant workers. They don't have to wear protective gear either. And within a single decade. Now, if we dawdle on this, it could take 20, 25 years. But if the nations of the world would say, let's go thorium as fast as possible, I think it could be done in 10 years, which means we only need the natural gas for a decade. Then we'll have the thorium. And how cheap would the power be? It's estimated that if we go full bore with thorium, you'd be paying half the price for your electricity that you would for parts of Canada where they get all their water, all their power from waterfalls. So, and that right now is the cheapest source of energy in the world. Electricity from, you know, water falling down, basically using gravity to generate electricity. So it's half the price of water power electricity. So it's the cheapest source of electricity in the world. That should give us an economic motive to pursue it. But I also see God's hand in this. We look at planet Earth and compare it with all the other rocky planets in the universe. We have 630 times as much thorium as what we expect in other rocky planets in the universe. We're sitting on the thorium champion of the universe. And there's reasons why we've got so much thorium. I mean, thorium comes from supernova eruptions and neutron stars merging together. 100% of the thorium comes from only 2 sources, supernova eruptions and neutron stars merging to become black holes. Now, supernova and black neutron star merging events, they begin to build up when the universe is young. So after a couple of billion years, you get more and more of these events. But there reaches a point where the supernova production rate begins to drop. And so there's a time in the history of our universe where thorium reaches a maximum abundance. That time was 4.5 billion years ago. When did our planet Earth form? 4.5 billion years ago. So our Earth formed at the peak of thorium abundance in the universe. Then another thing that explains why we have so much thorium is that we are orbiting a star, and our star was super enriched. It was that our solar system was born in a star cluster with about 20,000 stars. And of those 20,000 stars, several of them were supernova eruptions that were erupting at the time the solar system was forming, and also include neutron star merging events. And so because of where our solar system was born, we got super endowed with thorium. And then the third known incidence is when the planet Theia collided with the proto-Earth. And it was that collision that super endowed the Earth with uranium and thorium and all the other heavy elements. Basically, the light elements in that collision event were scattered into interplanetary space. The heavy stuff got absorbed into the Earth. Now, those are the three most significant factors, but we know of others that explain why planet Earth has 630 times as much thorium. But remember back in Genesis 1 where God made the promise, I'm promising you that you have all the resources you need to manage the planet for your benefit and the benefit of all life. And so he knew in advance the crises he would face. After all, it tells us in the book of Romans that God's intent would be, Romans and Revelation chapter 7, Romans 8, that God's intent is that an uncountable number of humans would be brought into a relationship with Jesus Christ, his son. And you say, how big is an uncountable number? That's in Revelation 7, 9. And at that time, the Greeks had a number system that went up to 1 billion. So it's basically a promise. Billions of humans will be redeemed. But it also means that God must have endowed the planet with the resources so that billions of people can live and thrive on the planet at one time. And so for that to be possible, he endowed our planet with all the resources we need so that billions of people can live a healthy enough life that they didn't discover the good news about the creator of the universe, providing them with an offer of salvation from their selfishness, their sin, and entry into an eternal, sinless, loving relationship with their creator. Now, if you want to read more about this, I actually wrote an article. It's on our website. It was posted on April 18th of this year. And so that's where you can get all the details. And the reason I spoke on this last week was simply, this is all new stuff in the scientific literature. It only got published in February and March, this kind of data. So you're wondering why Asia is not responding, why our government is not responding. Only now are we become aware of the extent of the health crisis and also aware of what it would take to solve it and how we can solve it by boosting the economy of all the nations of the world. I also look at this as a way to resolve some of the political tension we're facing. I think we're all aware that there's tension between India and China, and there's tension between China and the United States, and tension between China and Japan. But if we start giving them the natural gas and helping them build up these thorium nuclear reactors, there'll be an economic interdependence that possibly, I'm not saying it will, but possibly could play a role and lowering the tensions between these nations, particularly if they see us acting compassionately to help them with their health crises. And one reason why I think India is especially motivated, they're facing the greatest health crisis in this whole area. No nation is impacted more by particulate pollution than India. But the other thing that I think points to God's provision, India is sitting on the world's largest reserves of thorium. 30% of the thorium in the world is in this one nation of India. So they've got the resources right there. This could really, in fact, what I was sharing with people at UC Berkeley is that because of all the thorium that India has and how easy it is to mine, they could become an exporter of thorium to the rest of the world, Moreover, what would be better for the Indian economy? What if they become the number one exporter of thorium nuclear reactors? Well, in the audience, I didn't know this, was a member of the equivalent of India's parliament. He was sitting there in the audience and he said, "Hey, can I have a word with you? Do I have your permission to communicate your talk to the Indian government?" And I said, "Yeah, you do." And then 3 hours later, he said, "I've already communicated. And I'll let them know that you're willing to consult with them and see if we can get this whole process accelerated. We'll see what happens." And of course, I've written a book on this, Weathering Climate Change. Okay, as always in this class, we end it with open mic Q&A, where you can bring up any issue you want. It doesn't have to pertain to the talk that you just heard. And, you know, we were talking of being in a class about how for people below the equator, it's the beginning of spring. For us, it's the beginning of fall. And I don't know whether you're aware of this, but several people below the equator are participating in this class. This class is live streamed, and so when we do the Q&A, we always alternate between people that are participating through live streaming and people that are here in person. So we're going to begin with someone who's participating via live streaming, but that will give you time to think of a question you might have. If you got a question, go to the back of the microphone, because we want to be able to record both the question and the response to the question. So yes.
Okay. Yeah, Keith Wilson, I think he's in New Zealand. He said hi, and yes, first day of spring down there. So. Susan Lamb had a couple of comments. She said, "I had students who live with me from China. A woman from Beijing said she never saw the sun. And another one, when they came here, they were surprised to see blue skies. They had never seen it in their entire lives." Let's see, Robert Gibson has a question. He says, "What do you mean by biofuels? Are you referring to electricity generation from wood or liquid transportation biofuels for cars?"
Hey, good question. And yeah, Susan Lambeau, she's a nurse that participates with us. I think she's been with this class now for 35 years. If you're wondering how long I've been teaching the class, it's 49 years, almost going, in fact, October, it'll be 50 years that this Paradoxes class is. And hey, I'm not as old as you might think I am. I actually launched the class in my 20s, so now I'm in my 70s. Okay. But she's making a good point. And yes, we've all, I've been in Beijing, I've been in Shanghai, and yeah, it's on a really good day, you might be able to see something that's a mile away, but it's just like what that photo I showed you at Delhi, you can look at the sun in the daytime. One of our employees entertained an exchange student from China, and she said, "Hey, I got a question. What's that thing in the sky that I see?" And he said, "Well, that's the moon." He says, "Oh, you can actually see the moon?" She was raised in a city where she had never seen the moon. So, yeah, it really can get that bad. Rob Gibson's question again, can you remind me?
Asked, "What do you mean by biofuels? And are you referring to electricity generation from wood or liquid transportation biofuels for cars?"
Okay. Biofuel consumption in Asia is predominantly people taking garbage and trash and wood, sticks. They go around the neighborhood and gather up anything that's burnable, and they use that to cook their meals. So it's predominantly used for cooking. And hey, when it's cool, they use it for heating their homes. So biofuel is a catch-all for anything that can be burned that you can just gather up. And it also includes people who gather up the dung from their animals and they burn that. And now here in America, we use biofuels for our cars. That's also being done in some of the big cities of Asia. But most of the biofuels that are being burned in India and China and other Asian countries is just people gathering up trash, garbage, dung, whatever they can find, sticks that are lying around for cooking and heating. And so it's like if we could replace that with natural gas, where the natural gas is cheaper and you don't have to gather it up, that would solve a problem, but also means you would need a distribution system to get the natural gas into all of those homes. That can be done, but as I was mentioning, the fastest and quickest way to see some results, take care of the power stations, because they consume a lot of fuel. So,
Nonam has a question for you here.
Good morning. Welcome back.
Thank you.
In what you've described, we're talking about a number of transitions here. We're talking about a transition from oil and coal to gas, natural gas. Then another transition from natural gas to wind and solar. And then another transition from wind and solar to thorium. I don't know if I missed out. Maybe there's another one in there. But my question is this. Okay, the transition to natural gas technically is easy. Just a political decision. There will be time involved in the transition to wind and solar, and that transition involves, like you say, occupying a lot of land, and beyond that, we don't know what the replacement issues are with these instruments that you have to install for wind and solar. So those are unresolved problems. Okay, so my question is this. How about a direct transition from natural gas to thorium? Maybe you do a little wind and solar in the meantime, but that would seem to be, if we could do that, if we could have the political will to do that, that might be the way to go.
Yeah, that's a good point. And it's like, natural gas, the transition from coal and biofuels to natural gas, that's a fairly easy step. And it's quick, it's economic, the resources are already there. And, as a number of people pointed out, it's a challenge to get all of our electricity simply from wind and solar. It's a complement. It's going to be very challenging to get all of your energy just from wind and solar. And so I'm okay with generating wind and solar where it's economic, but we shouldn't look at that as the ultimate solution, which is why I'm saying thorium really is the ultimate solution. It actually generates electricity for less money than wind and solar, so it's cheaper than wind and solar, and it's reliable. You don't have to have the sun shining or the wind blowing to get the electricity. And there's lots of thorium in the crust of the Earth. The challenge with thorium is, well, there's two challenges. We don't yet know where the economic best construction point is. Are we better off constructing millions of small thorium nuclear reactors, or are we better off just constructing hundreds or thousands of really big ones? Now, there's a few nations in the world that are actually looking at thorium seriously. Israel, India, Canada, Australia, and the United States, and India and Israel are the most aggressive. And so one of the things I put in my talk at UC Berkeley is that India right now, I think, has got 11 experimental thorium nuclear reactors, and the motivation is they know they're sitting on huge reserves of thorium that's cheap and easy to mine. And so they're and Israel is also ahead because they're trying to relieve themselves of dependence on fossil fuels they don't have. But what I was saying in my talk is we need to motivate Israel and India, find out for us what is the cheapest and best thorium nuclear reactor to build. Because if we know that, then we can scale that up very quickly.
Could you tell me, what group was it that you talked to at UC Berkeley?
You can tell I'm suffering from this particulate matter pollution too.
How much PM 2.5?
Well, what happened is I got back from my trip when there was a forest fire burning just north of San Dimas, and so I'm still recovering from that. So, but that's mainly the big particulates, which I'll be able to throw off in a week or two. So,
question: I said, what group was it that you spoke to at UC Berkeley?
Okay, what was happening at UC Berkeley? They have an innovation forum where they're bringing together entrepreneurs, basically to say, okay, how can we use innovative technology to address the problems that the world is facing? And then there was a separate group. It was basically made up of leaders of different Christian organizations that are working in Asia. And so it was basically two groups that were, you know, speaking together on the UC Berkeley campus. It was organized by an economics and business professor at UC Berkeley. And, you know, of course, most of the people involved in Indian and Asian missions were Christians. Not all of them were, but most of them were. And most of the innovators were not Christians. But they got a lot of wealth, a lot of technology, and they want to see it used for a good purpose.
From Berkeley involved, like from chemical engineering and nuclear engineering?
Well, the reason why they, you know, they have this conference every year at UC Berkeley, and on purpose, they make sure that they're in the Silicon Valley. So they invite a lot of Silicon Valley people to participate. But it's not just people in Silicon Valley, it's entrepreneurs from all over the U.S. and Canada.
Okay, our friend Doug asked a question. Do you know if India is doing anything at all to clean up the Ganges River? There, half-burned bodies are dumped, and they bathe there. So do you know anything about that?
Well, that's interesting because the Ganges River is a well-known health problem that is being addressed. I spoke on the air pollution because that's actually getting less attention than what's happening with the rivers. And it's not just India. Rivers in Bangladesh likewise are facing a significant water pollution problem. And that's getting attention. It's being addressed. I'm not saying it's being addressed well, but at least people are aware of it and are working on it. I'm saying, hey, we have an even bigger health crisis than the water pollution. It's the air pollution. But yes, I've been to India, and even the small streams, you see all this floating plastic garbage. In fact, there are rivers and streams in India and other Bangladesh and other countries of the world where it's difficult to see the water because of all the trash that's floating on top. And so recycling is something that's not very prevalent in those parts of the world, mainly because it's not economic. And so, but again, you can look to the Western nations of the world. We found a way to motivate people to recycle their recyclables. And part of the problem is water is not safe to drink in many parts of the world there. I mean, when I went to India, I basically brought with me one of these, it's a little thing you can buy online. It's a little water purification system where you can literally just put this thing into a toilet and drink out of the toilet and you're fine. So, sorry about that picture, but that's really how good this device is. And so, because I realize, hey, what's happening in those parts of the world is that they don't drink water from the tap. It's all bottled water. What happens with the bottles? They throw it away. And so we need to find a way where people can drink water from the tap without getting sick, or maybe just distribute a lot of these filters around there. And so, or find a way to make it economic for people to recycle their plastic trash. Go ahead.
Yeah, I like what you're saying about hybrid energy technology where you kind of supplement electric with natural gas. And I kind of have a technical question. Is compressed natural gas?
Yes. I mean, that's, if I go back to this slide here. Yeah, that one. Okay. I mean, to ship natural gas in gaseous form from North America to Asia, simply is not economic. Methane is a very lightweight gas, so what they do is they compress the natural gas, actually liquefy it, and then they put it in these huge tanker ships, which means they can literally send millions and millions of cubic feet of natural gas in a single ship, bring it to an Asian port, and then they go from liquid natural gas to the gas form, and now they have the gas that they need. And the compression process does nothing to disturb the quality of the natural gas.
Okay.
So, but it does add an economic factor. Unlike here, where we just ship the natural gas into homes of North Americans from the source through pipes, we don't bother to liquefy it. It's just gas to gas. That's a cheaper way to do it. But if you want to ship it across an ocean, you have to liquefy it and then go from liquid to gas once you get to the place where it's needed.
And that's the same gas that, like, LA City buses run on currently? Is that right?
Well, for example, you can actually save quite a bit of money driving your automobile. What you do, in fact, I think you can go to JPL and they'll do it for a relatively modest price. Last time I heard it was $1,700 to take your gasoline or diesel car or truck and convert it to natural gas. Now, there is one downside. Your gas tank is going to be about 60% bigger than what you have now. And typically they put it in the trunk of your car. They don't bother messing with your gas tank, they just complement it. But now you're buying fuel for half the price, because so far our state doesn't tax the natural gas. And so literally you cut your fuel costs by a factor of two, and unlike burning diesel or gasoline, it releases only water vapor and a smaller carbon monoxide. There's no pollution. So when you see these buses, they will say clean natural gas. What they mean by clean is there's no particulate matter pollution, there's no aerosols, all they're releasing is water vapor and carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. And you literally cut the greenhouse gas emissions by nearly a factor of two. So it's a great way to go, but you will have a bigger tank.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, we have a question here from Terry. Dr. Ross, how do you guys like Jason Lyle and Faulkner able to get a, how were they able to get doctorates in astrophysics when they believe the universe is only 6,000 years old? And he goes on to say, I heard Lyle did his thesis on the sun being billions of years old.
Yeah, I know both of them personally. I've debated both of them. In fact, I've debated both of them at least twice. Danny Faulkner twice and Jason Lyle three times. And I've looked at their theses. They both have a PhD in astronomy from respected universities, but if you read their theses, it's an older thesis. And both of them told me they kept their young Earth beliefs secret until they got their doctoral degree. But yeah, if you read their thesis, it's like they're talking billions of years all the way through the thesis. So the ethics of that is open to question. But their whole point is, well, I had to keep it a secret because if they knew my position, they would have never granted me the degree. So yeah, their thesis is an old universe thesis in both cases.
Hi, Dr. Ross. I have a rather mundane situation at home. LA County now forbids you to build a new structure with a working fireplace. So I still have mine, and I still burn wood. And I have an arrestor on the top, and I have the proper things inside. The fireplace has been redone. But my question is, between fireplaces and cooking on charcoal grills outdoors, what can we do personally to make sure we're not polluting?
Okay, good question. And yes, you're right, in the state of California, you cannot buy a home where you're burning wood. They insist that it be natural gas or no fireplace at all. So, and if you have a fireplace that needs to be repaired, by law, you have to set it up so that it's natural gas and not wood. But it is grandfathered. If you got an old home where you got an old fireplace and chimney, you're still allowed to burn wood. But if you want something new or you want something repaired, yes, that law is in place. And yes, you're right about barbecues. It's like, hey, if our California politicians are that concerned about our fireplaces, why aren't they doing something about all the charcoal grills that people have? And yeah, I mean, there's literally millions of people charcoaling their burgers all over the state of California. So far, that's strictly legal. However, there is a pressure on place, hey, when you buy a barbecue grill from Home Depot or Lowe's, it's gonna have to be natural gas. So in our home, we got a hookup to our natural gas, so I don't like messing with the briquettes anyway, so, but I wouldn't be surprised if we see a transition where your grill has to be natural gas.
Mark, you're up.
Thing, just one comment. You know, everybody is saying it's bad to have a natural gas stove because it pollutes and you get asthma. It is true if you're breathing in methane, that's an issue. But we have a natural gas stove in our home. But I do pay attention to that. Notice if you got a natural gas stove, you got a fan. Turn the fan on before you turn on the natural gas. And even then, don't get too close to the stove. So if you do that, you're okay.
Hi, yes, you touched on it a little bit, even though it's off the topic a little bit, how events elsewhere in the universe affect the Earth. For example, the amount of thorium, and you mentioned black holes and things like that. So some of your videos talk about how everything in the universe is fine-tuned for God's purpose of redemption of mankind. And I can see maybe how some of it is perfect for life on Earth, but how does it, anyway, just to throw that on there to limit it a little bit more.
Well, I'll come back next week, because next week I'm going to talk about how we're in the safest place in the universe to deal with cancer. Anywhere else in the universe, we'd have a worse cancer problem. And the amazing thing is, people have this idea, if we could just get rid of all radiation, we'd have less cancer deaths. The truth is, you need a tiny amount of exposure to radiation to minimize the possibility of you getting cancer. And we happen to be living on the one planet where it's optimal. Everywhere else in the universe, it's worse. We're in the best spot. That's my talk next week.
Terry has a question again. On day four, according to Young Earth belief, there were no stars in the entire universe. If that was so, would that change the wording to let there be lights in the universe?
Yes, that is correct, that most Young Earth creationists believe that there was no sun, moon, or stars until creation day four. And that the statement in verse 14 of Genesis 1, let there be lights, is a statement that's when God created the sun, moon, and stars. And but I believe it's a wrong interpretation of the passage. What you notice there in Genesis 1:14, it does not use the word bara for create. It doesn't use the word asa to make. It uses the verb haya. Let there be. And so noticing that it uses that verb rather than create, the verb for create or make, implies that this is when the stars first appear to observers on the surface of the earth. And I think what's being overlooked by most young earth creationists is Genesis 1:2, establishes a frame of reference for interpreting the six creation days. It states that the Spirit of God is brooding on the surface of the waters of planet Earth, which implies that we're to interpret the account of the six creation days from the point of view of an observer on the surface of Earth's waters. Now notice what it says in Genesis 1:2. It's dark on the surface of the waters. If you go to a parallel creation text, Job 37, 38, and 39, which by the way, give you way more scientific details than what you get in Genesis 1, Job 38, 8, and 9 tells us why it's dark. It says, God blanketed the seas with clouds that kept the seas dark. So it's basically telling us in the context of Genesis 1:2, the clouds were opaque. And so creatures on the surface of the earth couldn't see the light of the sun, moon, and stars that God had created all the way back in Genesis 1:1 because the clouds would not let that light through. When it says, let there be light, that's God thinning Earth's primordial atmosphere. And as an astronomer, I can tell you, it got thinned by a factor of 200 times. Make our atmosphere 200 times thicker, no visible light gets through. And so that's the miracle of creation day one. So our thick atmosphere was replaced by thin atmosphere, and now light could appear. But until oxygen jumped from 1% up to 8%, the early atmosphere of planet Earth was hazy, way hazier than the photos I showed you. And it was that thick haze that prevented creatures on the surface of the Earth from seeing the objects that are responsible for the light. So when it says, let there be the great lights in the sky, so they may serve as signs to mark seasons, days, and years, that's referring to when the oxygen content in the Earth's atmosphere rose sufficiently to clear that haze out and allow creatures to see the sun, moon, and stars. Now, you also have to pay attention to Genesis 1:16. It says, so God made the sun, moon, and stars. But notice that's two sentences after Genesis 1:14. Genesis 1:14, let there be the great lights. Why? So they can serve as signs to mark seasons, days, and years. Who needs those signs? Creatures on the surface of the earth. With the atmosphere being cleared out by the rise of oxygen, they can see the sun, moon, and stars. And we're not surprised that there's a parenthetical note. These sun, moon, and stars you see, God made them. And when it says, so God made the sun, moon, and stars, it's implying that they were made by God sometime in the past. It doesn't tell you when, but if you go through the whole of the text, obviously it was before our creation day one. This is all in the book Navigating Genesis. And some of you have been here a few weeks ago. I did a series on the early chapters of Genesis. Those are all recorded. Go to paradoxes.org and you can get way more details than what I've shared with you in these past 2 minutes.
Here, my question's on clean coal. So if we go back 10 years more, it was all touted that the future for energy was going to be clean coal because coal is so abundant. I know it like doubles the price of the power plant and you have to have like more than double the land. Wouldn't that also be a solution for some of these immediate cities that are suffering? If they have the land available to go to clean coal and to start scrubbing the air and then storing the carbon underground?
Yes, that is an option. There are different kinds of coal. anthracite coal, for example, is quite clean. And you have a lot less particulates and way less aerosols. And then you got bituminous coal, which is dirtier. And then you got the brown coal, which is even dirtier again. So yes, that was something that people pursued. But you're right, it's about twice as much money to burn the clean coal as to burn the dirty coal. And what I'm suggesting is, why don't we just bypass coal entirely? Natural gas is cheaper than all forms of coal, but you'd be better off burning the clean coal than the dirty coal, but it's more money, it's not gonna help the Asian economy. Natural gas would be a big boost to the Asian economy because it's cheaper and also deals with all the health issues. You don't have any Even the clean coal is still quite dirty compared to natural gas by orders of magnitude. So that's why I said, let's just go straight to the natural gas.
Okay. Another question from Robert Gibson. Would using biofuels in transportation with hybrid and PHEVs, P-H-E-V-S, I think it's electric cars, with turbocharged engines and multimodal technology reduce particular emissions enough? Do you get that?
No, I get that. And, you know, because of our advanced economy and the fact that we have so much agricultural land, what's happening here in the United States and in Canada is they raise a lot of corn, and they use that corn to produce ethanol. And so you can go to the gas station, and if you got the kind of appropriate kind of car engine, you can actually take the pump that says 15% ethanol, 85% gasoline, and if you put that in there, it's cleaner than burning just the gasoline. So that's one way to help, but again, it doesn't compete with natural gas. Natural gas is orders of magnitude cleaner, and it's cheaper. And keep in mind, we have the luxury of turning corn into ethanol. Most of the nations in Asia don't have that luxury, is that, you know, we got a huge surplus of corn. And then you got the problem is, well, if you're getting all your ethanol from corn, how much fossil fuels are you burning to plant and harvest all that corn? I mean, if you've ever been to the cornfields, you notice that they're using machinery that's being run by fossil fuels to plant the corn, to cultivate the corn, and to harvest the corn. So it's not really as clean as what some people think.
Jamalama has a question. He wants to know, what's the name of your article? Articles are not listed by date on your site.
Okay, yeah, that's, I could look up the name of the article. If you simply, here's the fastest way to find it. Go on our reasons.org website and look up blogs, then put my name in, Hugh Ross, it'll come up with my blogs. And I think it's the last blog that's been posted on our website. We're now doing everything through YouTube because we're rebuilding our website. So there's basically been a moratorium on me writing articles. I write articles for other people, but right now I'm doing everything through YouTube. And by the way, I got a new feature on YouTube called News of the Day, where I keep you up to date on the latest scientific discoveries that have significance for the Christian faith. I posted one just this past Saturday. So you can go to the Reasons to Believe YouTube channel and you'll see News of the Day. And they're about 15 minutes long. They're quite easy to see. And feel free to share them with your friends. But I think that's the fastest way to find the article. And by the way, we have an advanced feature on our website where you can search by date. So if I know the date of something I've written, I just put in, say, well, April 2017 to April 2017. Maybe a dozen articles will pop up that have been written by people on our team, and I can quickly find something that way. So if you look underneath, you'll see advanced search. So you really can search by date.
A question from Kenny. Dr. Ross, you've mentioned the benefit of following the Sabbath before. My understanding is we are no longer under the Mosaic Law. Could you comment on that?
Well, we're no longer under the Mosaic Law, that part of the Mosaic Law that was foretelling the coming of Christ. So there are three components to the Mosaic Law. There's the moral component, there's a ceremonial component, and there's that component which was designed to point people towards the coming of the Messiah. So there's New Testament passages are saying, we don't need that anymore because the Messiah has already come. And the ceremonial part, again, was all focused on, hey, what do we do with our sins? Well, Jesus has already come and paid for all of our sins. However, what the New Testament makes clear is that the moral part of the law still stands, and the Sabbath is part of that moral law. And each component of the moral law, you need to look at the principle behind it. What's the principle of the Sabbath? And I've written articles on this, and there's a YouTube talk I gave on this, saying the fundamental principle of the Sabbath, we all need to take time out from our busy workday schedule, work week schedule, to focus on the most important issues of life. And so in that sense, I'm saying it doesn't have to be Saturday, it doesn't have to be Sunday, but you need to take time out on a weekly basis to focus on the most important issues of life. And the article I've written, I made a reference to how easy it is in Western society to get addicted to your work. Because what's happening today is we have a lot of people who love their jobs, and love their jobs to such a degree that's all they think about. And so what I wrote in that piece is my encounters with scientists who describe themselves as atheists. But as I engage them, I find out they're not real atheists, they're default atheists. They're so addicted to their scientific research, that's all they think about. And so they never, in fact, I remember talking to this one famous paleontologist and said, you know, have you ever thought about you're gonna die one day? No, I never give that any thought. Ever thought about whether there might be something beyond the universe? No, I never give that any thought. And it's like, well, you are aware that your life here on Earth is temporal. And maybe if you're lucky, you might live 90 years. You ever thought about what might happen after you die? No, I never give. They're so addicted to their scientific research, they never consider the most important issues of life. So I basically challenge them, saying, you know, I know you, says, I understand your addiction. There's a thrill about making a scientific discovery that no one has ever really come upon. It's a rush. And a lot of scientists live for that rush. But it's like, hey, take time out and focus on the most important issues of life. And not just do it for yourself, but do it for the people that are part of your family and your friends. That, to me, is what the Sabbath is all about. You stop your normal work and spend time with God and your family and your friends, focusing on the most important issues of life. But I do agree we shouldn't get legalistic about it. Just make sure you're spending regular time.
Okay, Dr. Ross, we're out of time. Can you close us in prayer now, please?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. Father in heaven, we thank you that you have given us a Sabbath where we can come together and focus on the most important issues of life. Help us to use that time wisely. Help us to use it not just for our benefit, but for the benefit of people we know and thus spend time with. And we thank you, too, for the privilege of living in the 21st century, where so much is being revealed from the book of nature and your book, the book of Scripture. Help us to be diligent in studying both books, integrating them for the benefit of serving you as Creator, Lord, and Savior. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you. Thank you.